Welcome to Nowhere to Run with Christopher White.
Chris in Tennessee, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey everyone, welcome to Nowhere to Run. My name is Chris. Thank you for tuning in. I think I have a very important and informative show for you today, so we'll just get right into it. It's going to be concerning the Gog-Magog War primarily, and this is something that I've talked extensively about on the show. I've talked about it elsewhere. I've used it in recent, talking with people saying, you know, hey, you know, this whole war seems to be shaping up just like the Gog-Magog War with Russia and everything else, and Turkey and Libya and Syria and all this stuff. Well, not Syria, but Iran. And it's been a big thing that I've talked about. And I think that I may owe all of you an apology because I think that I fell into some hype with the whole situation. And I'll show you what I mean later. And I think it's really important to just go through the details because I think the text makes it very clear. It's actually obvious what's being said there. So it just is a matter of going through the words themselves and then discussing the implications of that, comparing it to what we have believed about the Gog-Magog War for a long time. So we'll talk about that here in a second, but first I'll basically be discrediting. You can feel good if you don't like my conclusions about the Gog-Magog War. You can be like, oh, well, he's crazy anyway because of what I'm about to play, which is a clarification about the last podcast I did about mana, where I was pointing that it very possibly could be the Terafizia and Termania desert truffle, which are these extremely rare food-like substances that grow in the desert. And so there was a lot of questions and things that came up from them, so I felt obligated to play a clip. It's about 12 minutes long from the Frank and Chris show last night, where I tried to clarify my position because I was getting a lot of emails and things like that, and deal with some of the common things I was hearing, and a caller called in and asked some more things that were also being asked. So I thought I'd play this 12-minute clip here before we get into the Gog-Magog thing. That way, kind of lighten the mood. That way, if you really don't want to believe me about the Gog-Magog thing, it'll be give you a really easy out. You can be like, oh yeah, Andy thinks some crazy stuff about this too. So we'll just write him off and move on to the next thing. So anyway, we'll do that real quick, and then we'll talk about the very serious situation with the Gog-Magog War. Here you go.
Well, actually, I got one more thing I should probably talk about. Looks like I got some confusion about it, and I might be confused about it myself, but I told Silverman I'd mention this and stuff. Is I just did a short video about mana called Mystery Mana Solved? And I think it raises one of the things. Basically, the gist of it is that mana may be what's called the Terafizia and Termania desert truffle, and they are these really rare things. Nobody really knows. I mean, I think the locals say that they like are formed by lightning from, you know, where lightning strikes or something like that. I'm sure there's actual reason, but they're just these really interesting little things that are extremely nutritious, extremely high in protein, have like these things that like cure staph infection in them, antibiotics and stuff like that. You can eat them in all kinds of different ways, and they're nutritious and delicious. They were sought after, very rare delicacy, sought after kings and princes and stuff like that. But they're very rare. They're kind of hard to find, and they grow in the exact area in the desert of that area, the Middle East and the Southern Mediterranean, Egypt, Israel desert. And they're these just little things that will do the exact same things that the Bible says as far as a lot of different things. They will grow overnight, and they don't have any seed or root or anything, but what perks out of the sand of the morning dew is this part that gets bleached white and flaky, and they basically and if you leave them out, if you don't gather them for that day, they will get larvae in them, and they will stink, and then they will melt. So I mean, it's like fulfilling a lot of those different kind of characteristics. And so, but the main point of the video was to refute the idea that it was this whole, I'm sure you've run into quite a lot, is the whole magic mushroom, mana was magic mushroom theory, which is quite prevalent. I don't know why, but it just is, as far as in the alternative media. And that's what it mainly does, is completely destroy that argument. It just sends it right on back into the new age, I think. But the thing is, but there's a lot of controversy, and I'm not trying to say it necessarily is or whatever, but I think the controversy is it kind of feels like it's taking a lot of the supernatural aspects of mana out of the situation. And I would say to that, I don't think it does at all for a few different reasons. And I'm not saying it is necessarily, but here would be my reasons. Like, okay, people would gather the mana per person, or the head of the household will go gather mana, and they would always end up gathering exactly the same amount that they needed for their family. And that's actually how Moses would tell, like, if somebody's servant was theirs or not, is that he would kind of wait in the morning and then judge by which family had gained, had gathered that extra person's mana. So, I mean, there was way more than any, like, this would actually be. I mean, there was millions of people in the desert that were being fed off this. So, I mean, it was obviously more than anybody has ever seen before of this particular very rare truffle. And the idea that it stopped and started at certain times, I mean, which is not, but all my point is that it seems like throughout the Bible, a lot of miracles have been using extremely natural things in a very miraculous way. And I think that, you know, you see things like that all the time with God's miracles. It kind of operates within the natural, the laws of nature, I guess you could say. And there are exceptions to that, too, obviously. I mean, he's God. He can do literally anything he wants. But I think that, for the most part, he uses kind of the chess pieces that are here. So that's my point. The main things, and again, I'm not trying to. Here's a few things. Okay, these things do grow in the desert. I mean, if in the very same place they would have been wandering in, you know, in the middle of. So I'm saying, and they grow every morning. You find a new crop. So while at the very least, while the Israelites were gathering manna, they were running across these things, which were doing the exact same things that manna was. And so I just I don't know. The main things I've seen is that it says it comes from heaven, and I don't really have an answer for that. I mean, I don't know. I could conjecture that. I mean, they do. I mean, they totally operate off the dew, which does come from heaven. I mean, like I said, the indigenous people really do think. I mean, go to Wikipedia and look up the Terephthysian Termanian mushroom. They say it grows because lightning strikes. But I mean, it's just kind of folklore, as far as I guess. But I don't know. I mean, I don't really have an answer for all these things, but I think that it just all the different things, it's something very interesting. I haven't seen anybody mention it before. And I think the reason why it works for the psychedelic mushroom crowd is because, I mean, that's what Satan has always done. It's basically used something that is kind of true in this case, that it was kind of from that same, had the same characteristics of a mushroom in a lot of respects, but very few, and used it to basically get people. I was talking to, like, the head of this whole, he's not the head of it, he'd like to think he was probably, but the of this psychedelic mushroom kind of thing, and he actually has courses where he gets people to basically, like, what, like a quarter pound of these things, sit in a dark room, and, you know, channel beans and so on. I mean, he probably wouldn't say that, but, you know, that's what other people are doing with it. So, I mean, it's getting people to open doors, and I normally would have said before, you know, that these mushrooms don't necessarily put you in direct contact with some of these beings and stuff. But ever since I've been talking about this, I've been talking to all the people that are very clearly, you know, doing that with it. So, and I think it has to do with the dose and different things, but that's what it ultimately leads to. I'm getting off the subject, so I'll let you see what you got to say about any of that.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I'm definitely going to have to check that out. And, I mean, it sounds really interesting as far as, you know, the mushroom stuff.
Yeah. One cool story about it was this one woman. It's in the video where she basically eats them every day. It was during a famine, so this is like in the 70s or whatever, and that year the crop of these things were very plentiful, and so she ate them every day for 4 months and just cooked them in all kinds of different ways. You can just do everything with them. You can cook them in all kinds of ways. She said they cooked them like meat, like as they normally would cook meat and stuff like this. And she said at the end of the 4 months, she wasn't tired of them. She still found them, you know, nutritious and tasty. You can make bread and you can use them as meat. And I mean, these things are just like wonder things. And they are, you know, they do, if you don't gather them every morning, which they appear completely. And that's what, and it's interesting because the Talmud talks about them when they say they appear suddenly overnight, perfectly round, like little potatoes. And, you know, Muhammad apparently in one of the writings attributed to him or whatever says that he calls it manna. He's like, these truffles are manna that Allah gave to the Israelites. And they, you know, and he said, and he also said, and their juice can be used for an eye remedy. And actually it can be, it has to do with that. Staphylococcus, whatever thing. So it's interesting. But if anybody wants to talk about it, whatever, that'd be cool.
The other thing I wanted to bring up real quick was, it's not a big deal. I don't think it's an issue or of any sort, but was the manna thing. I agree with you on your podcast up to a point on that it's not the psychedelic drug that it was, that it's been portrayed as in some circles, but some of the aspects that you, or some of the descriptions you used for the truffles and to the manna, they don't all match. A lot of them do, but not all of them. Some of the ones that don't match are the fact that you were saying they gathered what they needed, but they also used up everything they had, and it would even go bad in their house. Now, the truffles don't do that. Once you grind the truffle up or turn it into a flour or a juice or whatever it is you want to use it for, it'll last you, you know, just as long as regular flour would. The Israelites were only supposed to gather what they needed and then use it up in that 24-hour period and then gather more again in the morning. And if they gathered more than they needed, it would rot in their house. It doesn't matter what they did with it.
But does it say that specifically that it makes that thing, that if they ground it up or dried it, it would then go bad? I'm just saying. I mean, these things obviously go bad if you didn't use them in the day anyway. But if it makes that caveat that they grounded it up and then they still went bad, then that's an issue, I think.
Well, I'm not 100% sure on that. I do know that they couldn't keep any overnight, which you did state. Obviously, the same thing would happen with the truffle. You can't keep it overnight. The big issue is that the entire Bible that talks about manna talks about it being food from heaven, heavenly food, and food that God rained down on them is what you find in the New Testament, which, as opposed to the truffles that come up from the earth.
Well, let me quickly say something on that. I don't think that you find anywhere in the Bible where they are seen coming from heaven or falling from this or anything like that. It's just a title. The only thing that you do see the Israelites doing is they get them from the ground. They get them from the ground. I'm not trying to sell that idea necessarily, but I would say if this is right, which it might not be right, but if it is right, there probably some kind of confirmation come in the way of the words being used from heaven there, or find some kind of confirmation through the truffles thing. Like I said, there's a lot of speculation, these things being so rare that people don't really know much about them. So I don't know. I mean, like I said, I'll have to say I don't know. But you know, if it's true, it'll come out one way or another.
I just thought your video debunked both the psychedelic mushrooms and the God aspect of it were basically,
yeah, I was afraid,
like,
of that.
You know, God basically through Moses, hey, look, what you're walking on, food you guys can eat. Here's how you can harvest it. Here's how you can store it. Here are the details. Stop complaining. You're surrounded by food, sort of thing.
Yeah, you know. But that's kind of it. I mean, there were so many. There's still, if what is said in the Bible happened, it still has to be incredibly miraculous to those. I mean, the amount, the quantity, the length of time that they were there, the stopping when they were there, the mere fact that they were there, in the sense that, you know, they're going with faith into the desert, not knowing how they're going to get any kind of food, and here we are, we have these perfect little foods, you know, right on the desert floor.
Right.
So I don't know. I see I see it possibly being it only, and I know that the video, because I tried to cram it all in 9 minutes, you know, or 10 minutes, trying to make sure, you know, people would watch it or whatever. If I had it to do over again, which I might do because it's definitely really rough, is to definitely bring in all the supernatural aspects of it that still remain, and also to really illustrate how rare these things are. I think the problem with the video as it is that it kind of gives the impression that these things, you just trip over them if you go to the Middle East, which is not the case. They're very rare. And so I think those two points are important.
Right. No, you're right. yeah. And I, you know what, I'd never heard somebody bring up the desert truffle theory. Not that I've been researching manna or anything like that.
Okay, one more thing that wasn't addressed in that conversation is that somebody had emailed and said that mushrooms weren't kosher in Jewish tradition. And I didn't find any place in the Bible where it says that mushrooms are not kosher or prohibited in the dietary laws. There is some talk about like white spots in your clothing and that's not good. And if you have white spots on your, you know, face, you have leprosy or something like that. And I think that a lot of the Jewish traditions nowadays have made that to mean that mushrooms, because they're also fungus, are not good to eat, which I think is, I mean, it may be true, but it's not prohibited in the very specific dietary laws, as far as I know. I could be wrong. And so I think this is kind of more of like, you know, as Jesus was railing against the Pharisees of his day of making the law to none effect because they would, you know, make so many extra laws regarding the Sabbath, you know, probably at one time trying to do good, but, you know, had made it so hard, impossible to follow because of their traditions. And I could be, just again, I'm not trying to say this is it, this has got to be this way by any means. I'm saying if it is right, it'll be validated through, you know, further study. You know, I'm just putting it out there, and I'm not married to it at all. You know, I'm just putting it out there. Okay, so that's about all on that. And let's get into some serious stuff. I'll take a really quick break, and I'll be right back, and we'll talk about the Gog-Magog War.
Russ Dizdar explains his ministry, Shatter the Darkness.
Almost 20 years now, we've been just kind of just trying to help people, minister to people, share with people coming out of cults, you know, just mind control, the occult, left-hand path stuff. And then we ran into the real underground that's been going on for a long time. And so it has a lot to do with deliverance and dealing with the dark side and power encounters and, you know, as confronting perpetrators of violence on children and ritual abuse. It deals with healing the hearts of the victims and, you know, keeping our guard and trying to do what we can to expose it, stop some of it.
You can visit Russ Dizdar's website at shatterthedarkness.net, where you'll find hours of free MP3s and podcasts, as well as courses for your church or your ministry to begin to learn how to deal with encounters of this nature in a biblical way. shatterthedarkness.net.
Revelations Radio Network. Many hosts, one message of salvation. RevelationsRadioNetwork.com.
I know I've talked a whole lot about this before, and if you've listened to the show for any length of time, you know that my general position is that the War of Gog and Magog is what's shaping up right now with Russia, Iran, Turkey, Libya, and the Sudan, and that I think that it is the fulfillment of Ezekiel 38 and 39. This is the general view of people like Hal Lindsey and Chuck Missler. And I've really never seen any reason to question that until about 2 nights ago. And I was on a forum. It was a Christian forum. It's not one I'm a part of, but I was just looking around, and the title of the thread was something like, does the rapture happen before the War of Gog or Magog or after? And I know that people like Chuck Missler have always said that they are pretty convinced that the rapture happens before the War of Gog, Magog. And they also think that it is the next thing that we will probably see in the prophetic timeline. So, what struck me is that some people, people were arguing kind of back and forth. They weren't arguing, they were just talking about it. And then certain people would say things like, you know, I don't see any reason why it should be a double fulfillment of prophecy. I don't see any reason why Ezekiel 38 and 39 must come be a separate war than the one spoken of in Revelations 20. And I'm like, what? It's like, and for some reason, I never really don't think I even took into account what was said in Revelations 20, which is clearly indicating that a war of Gog and Magog that is precisely the same thing and is very, very heavily and permanently linked to the Ezekiel 38 and 39 passages is clearly saying that it is after the millennial reign. And let me just read a little bit of that Revelations 20 altogether. It says, and when the 1,000 years are expired, okay, that's important. It's after the 1,000 years of peace. When the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison and shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together for battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. And they went up on the breadth of the earth, and compassed the camp of the saints about, and the beloved city. And fire came down from God out of heaven, and devoured them. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are, and shall be tormented day and night for ever and ever. There are a few things to take into account here. First, that this war of Gog Magog is exactly like the one in Ezekiel 38 and 39. It starts the same way, it ends the same way, involving the same people in the same war, and except here in Revelations 20, it's clearly saying that it is after the millennial reign. And so there isn't any way except for it being a double fulfillment of prophecy. If we are expecting to see that happen very soon, it has to be a double fulfillment of prophecy, which I'm not necessarily against. It's just we need to look for any indication of it being a double fulfillment. And it also would help to see if there's anything that excludes the possibility of, or to read Ezekiel 38 and 39 and see if there's anything in that passage that makes us think it has to be before the millennial reign. So I'm going to go through, first, I'll probably read some of Ezekiel and comment on that, and then I'm going to go through some of the common questions that I've heard both in that forum and in the Frank and Chris show last night, where we had a very interesting discussion about all this stuff. So let me just go through some of the things. First, let's read some passages in Ezekiel 38. It says, after many days, thou shalt be visited in the latter years, thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword. First, that word, latter years, those words, latter years, is the only time that that's mentioned in the Bible. It says latter days a lot of times, but the only time it ever says latter years is in this verse right here. And I'm not trying to overplay that significance there, but generally speaking, it seems like if there's only, is there a phrase only mentioned one time in the Bible, it's usually significant. I think that is consistent with if this is a large prophecy about something that happens literally after the millennial period, after 1,000 years of peace. So this is extremely far in the future, and I think that's why it's contrasted with latter days and uses the term latter years here instead. Although it does mention latter days also in the same chapter. So let's just read. In the latter years thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword and is gathered out of many people against the mountains of Israel, which have been always waste, but it is brought forth out of the nations, and they shall dwell safely, all of them. Well, this could and very well be talking about Israel now, because they are brought back from the land, and I think this is one of the things that makes people automatically assume that we're talking about right now, is because this would be consistent with the Jewish people getting the nation of Israel, but I would also suggest that this would also be true after the millennium. And it says, Ezekiel 38:10, "Thus saith the Lord, it shall also come to pass that at that time shall things come into thy mind, and thou shalt think an evil thought." Well, I find this really, really interesting, because in Revelation 20, it's telling you why they had that evil thought. And listen to what the evil thought makes them do. "And thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of the unwalled villages. I will go to them that are arrest and dwell safely, all of them dwelling without wall." So that's the evil thought that they think. Let me read that again. "Thus saith the Lord God, it shall also come to pass that at that same time shall things come into thy mind, and thou shalt think an evil thought, and thou wilt say, I will go into the land of unwalled villages." Okay, but in Revelation 20, it's telling them why that happens. It says, "And when 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison, and shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together for battle, the number of whom is at the sand of the sea." And they, so Satan is let out of a prison, and his first order of business, first thing that he does after he gets out of jail, is to go deceive the nations which are at the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together for battle. So that's the evil thought. I mean, if Satan's first order of business is to go deceive nations, to put a thought in their head to of Gog and Magog to do what is said here, which is to encompass the beloved city and all that stuff. I mean, we're talking about the same thing. John is expanding on what Ezekiel said. John's telling you what that evil thought in Ezekiel that came into their mind that made them go unto Israel was. But let me continue reading. It says, "Thus saith the Lord God, it shall come to pass that at that time shall things come into thy mind, and thou shalt think an evil thought. And thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls, and having neither bars nor gates." This was brought up in the forum, saying that this was not what we see in Israel. They are obviously expecting war at any day. They think that they're surrounded by 100,000 rockets. They are very cautious. They're not at peace at any means. And I've heard people say, well, what they're talking about with unwalled villages is different, because back then villages, you know, had these other kinds of walls, and so technically they don't have unwalled villages, and they are technically at peace and everything. And that's fine if it just stopped there, but I mean I don't know if that's fine anyway, but it keeps going. It makes this extremely clear that they're at rest and at peace and are unsuspecting and don't have any walls. It says, "I will go to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls, and having neither bars nor gates." Those last three things are just reiterating that. Dwelling without walls, and having neither bars nor gates. And I'm telling you that I think that this is what we would see in the millennial period. Keep in mind, the millennial period will go by, apparently without a hitch, an entire 1,000 years of rest, where it will be peace. But it says in Revelation 20, verse 7, that this Gog and Magog war happens after the 1,000 years are expired. Then Satan shall be let out of his prison. So it's after that that Satan is loosed. And it says earlier in Revelation 20, it kind of describes why this must happen. It says, Revelation 20, verse 3, it says, "And cast him into the bottomless pit, and shut him up, and set a seal upon him, that he should deceive the nations no more, till the 1,000 years should be fulfilled. And after that, he must be loosed a little season." So it again links his being loosed to deceiving the nations. And then it says, until the 1,000 years, where he will deceive the nations again. So that's what his job is, and that's what we see later on in Revelation, that he goes out to deceive the nations. And so I think that during 1,000 years of peace, with Jesus Christ literally ruling from Jerusalem, you will see a group of people that are dwelling safely without walls and bars and gates, because lions are laying down with lambs and things like that. So that's what I think. We see a clearer picture here rather than the Israel that we're seeing today. I think to just pretend like Israel is at peace and that it doesn't have bars and doesn't have walls, villages, and are at, you know, not and suspecting anything, it would be unproductive. Here's another point in Ezekiel 38, verse 23. It says, this is after he destroys the advancing armies. It says, thus I will magnify myself and sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of many nations, and they shall know that I am the Lord. I had a caller in the Frank and Chris show last night that said that this was evidence that it was before the millennial period, because he said there would be no reason for them to know that, to prove that he was the Lord after that period. And so that's, and I would say that this is not, I think you can look at it like this. If what we think is going to happen happens, let's say there is an advancing army, a Russian army and everything, and Israel destroys it, and they nuke them, and they totally, or it happens by earthquake and fire and brimstone, just in a very miraculous way like that. To think that the world in the state that it is wouldn't come up with an excuse of why that happened, you know, rationalize it in this day and age, is, to me, I mean, just not paying attention to what we've done and what we can rationalize away wasn't actually God. Not to mention the fact that clearly there still is a Armageddon war and an entire deceived nation marching on towards Armageddon after this. So you would have, obviously, everybody didn't know that the Lord was the Lord, or, you know, they would have not continued with the rest of the time and gone straight into Armageddon and everything. I think really what you see at the end of Revelation, especially at the end of this Gog and Magog war in Revelation 20, is just exactly that. It seems that after this, and after Satan is thrown to the pit, after this is when you really do see the world for the first time after the millennium really, really knowing that God is God, and it looks like everything is pretty well hunky-dory after that. And so I think that this is more speaking of a time after Satan is finally done away with, that, and they all know that I am the Lord. That, if that is to be taken as literally as possible, that they all shall know that I am the Lord, this is more indicating of a time after Revelations 20 and the beginning of Revelations 21 than the end of, you know, a recent or a up and coming war, in my opinion. Another verse in, well, let's just talk about some of the things. I already mentioned the idea of the evil thought and the unwalled villages, the latter years being the only time that it was mentioned, the known in the eyes of the Lord, the double prophecy. I don't see any reason, and I'm going to play the Ezekiel 38 and 39 verses and audio of those, and I want you to do like I did two days ago, when I was just basically listening to these Ezekiel 38 and 39, and it went by so fast, because it was the first time I sat there and was like, okay, I'm going to listen to this, looking for a reason not to think that this is talking about the millennial period. You know, realizing that I don't know a whole lot about the millennial period as far as what we're going to need and what are we going to be doing. Are we going to have cattle? Apparently we're going to have cattle and things like that, and so we'll be literally living. And I think this speaks to another, anyway, to finish that thought, which I am not very good at doing. So I'm going to play that and just listen to it as if this may be something that happens at the millennium, and see if anything strikes you as good or bad about it. One of the things that was brought up, both on the forum that I read and last night, was in Ezekiel 39, it talks about the weapons of this advancing army will be essentially used for energy purposes for 7 years. Now, this has been conjectured by many people, including Hal Lindsey and Chuck Missler, that this was some sort of nuclear weaponry that is converted and used for energy purposes. First of all, I'd say I don't know that that is necessarily exactly what it is. It certainly could be, and I would say that if it is, I don't see any problem with it. And this is why. I don't see why having the fact that Satan gets out of the pit and gathers the nations together for war, and there's enough people that he gathers that it says that they're as many as the sands of the sea. So there's enough people in the world after the millennial reign that are going to be dissenters. It doesn't really give a time frame. It just is a short time or a little season, I think, is what it says. It doesn't really make that clear of whether or not in Satan's gathering together for war, maybe they have time to gather together, you know, those types of weapons and things like that. You have to imagine that in this millennial period, it'll be a very interesting time because we will be people with the memory of high technology, if not high technology still. I think that it is going to be interesting because we'll be, whether or not the earth will be in shambles or restored, I'm not sure. I kind of lean towards it being restored during the millennial period. But I don't think that means that just because Jesus is here, he's going to be like, we have to go right back to not having any technology or anything like that. I think that for some reason, there will be kind of like a harmony imbalance with it. I do think that we'll definitely be right going back to the ways that we should live, you know, kind of earthy kind of situation. But I don't think that means that, you know, these kinds of things are going to be forbidden. Maybe they will. But even if there is no such thing as technology during this time, there might be after Satan is let out of the pit to go deceive the nations to war. So there could be nuclear weapons. And what would you expect to do if he did destroy them from attacking the land of Israel and they did make nuclear weapons? Isn't that what you'd expect God to do with nuclear weapons? It's like, hey, it's cool. We'll just make it into energy. You know, we'll just use it for good. And that's what he's always done with Satan's stuff. You know, he finds a way to use it for good. And as Russ Dizendorf says, the lamb always runs circles around the dragon. So I don't see that as a reason to say that it is. I mean, if that's your argument, then you have to concede that we don't know enough about the millennium to say that it has to be this way or has to be that way. And I think that's why Ezekiel is so unique, and maybe that's why it's the only time that the latter years is mentioned, is because not a lot of prophets were prophesying this extensively about something that happened after the millennia. I really do think that it is the case, it's a possibility that we are going to get a lot more revelation from God himself during this 1,000 years peace, which some people, including myself, have conjectured that this 1,000 years of peace is actually kind of like a millennial Sabbath. If you take the age of men, since men have been here, at least in our neshema, our soul form, since Adam, you can really trace back that to 6,000 years when God breathed the neshema into the nostrils of Adam, and that's thus civilization essentially began. And if you take that as 6,000 years, maybe we're about to go into a 1,000-year Sabbath, because God has a Sabbath for everything. He's got a Sabbath for, you know, weeks and years and all that kind of stuff. And centuries, it seems like. I don't know about centuries. I haven't seen that. But anyway, it's just a conjecture, really. But my point is that if during this 1,000 years, Jesus is literally ruling in a physical way, in a physical world, and he's talking to us, just by him talking to us, we'll be having revelation that people will be taking notes. You know, it's like, this is, you know, and he probably will be talking more about what's going to happen or whatever. We'll have like a whole new set of revelation from God. So I think that stuff that Ezekiel's talking about will, you know, all that stuff would be more widely known, because he's going to be telling us what we need to know then, if we're on a need-to-know basis, you know. I don't know. And, of course, that's really conjecture, and I'm not trying to tell you anything about that, but those last few things that I mentioned. So let's look at some more things. This next thing is extremely interesting, and this was pointed out and discovered last night on the Frank and Chris show, is that Revelations 21 and Ezekiel 40 seem to be talking about the same things. And this is confirmation. It was confirmation to us last night, I think, is a consensus that this was confirmation that they were talking about the same things. Because in Revelations 21, this is after everything gets done and Satan is thrown into the pit and everything's going to be hunky-dory. The next thing that says in Revelations 21 is, "And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and I saw John, the holy city, and the new Jerusalem coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as the bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a voice saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and he shall be his people, for God himself shall dwell with them and be their God. And God shall wipe away all the tears from their eyes, and there shall no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. So this is after everything's good. I mean, really good. I mean, there was the millennial period, then Satan was loosed, then this Gog-Magog conflict happened, and then they finally destroyed Satan forever, and then things got really good. And the next thing this starts talking about is measuring the temple. And he starts describing this new Jerusalem and the gates thereof and the walls thereof, and the city lieth foursquare, and the length is as large as the breadth. And he measured the city, which was the reed, which is 12,000 furlongs. The length and the breadth and the height of it are equal. And he measured the wall thereof. So he's describing the millennial temple, which is extremely, extremely interesting, because at the end of Ezekiel 38 and 39, you have logically Ezekiel 40. And Ezekiel 40 is also a very detailed measuring of the city and the tabernacle of God. Now, the caller last night was saying, okay, here we have proof that this temple is not the same one being talked about in Revelation, because after Revelation 21, it starts talking about measuring a temple, and it's clearly the new temple, the new Jerusalem there. So the idea was that this one, and Ezekiel, after Ezekiel 38, the Ezekiel 40, or Ezekiel 39 and Ezekiel 40 passages where they're measuring the temple is not the millennial temple. But I've found that a lot of people really pretty much assume, quite separate from the whole thing, this is also talking about a millennial temple. And there's a lot of reasons to believe this. First of all, in Ezekiel 43, keep in mind, Ezekiel's being walked around here by somebody he describes as... he brought me thither, and behold, there was a man whose appearance was like that appearance of brass with a line of flax in his head, and a measuring reed, and stood by the gate. So he's walking around with this guy and measuring all this stuff in this temple. And then later on, he says things like, afterwards, he brought me to the gate, even the gate that looketh towards the east. And behold, the glory of God of Israel came from the way of the east. And that's interesting, because he's saying that ostensibly here in past tense, that was the gate that the Lord came from. But Ezekiel was not in a position to say that the Lord, oh yeah, he came from the east gate. No, he didn't enter in through the east gate. He was prophesied to, I don't know if at this point or not, but that's something that he's saying has already happened. And then later on in Ezekiel 44, he says, then he brought me back the way of the gate of the outward sanctuary, which looketh towards the east, and it was shut. Then the Lord said unto me, this gate shall be shut, it shall not be opened, and no man shall enter by it, because the Lord, the God of Israel, hath entered in by it, therefore it shall be shut. And that could mean today, you know, that could be a vision of him, you know, seeing what the situation is right now, because that gate is shut up, you know, it is walled up, and maybe that's the reason it is because the Lord entered in through it. And that necessarily wouldn't mean that, but I'm suggesting that this might be talking about after the millennia, after Jesus actually breaks that wall down and enters in through the east gate of Jerusalem once again to claim his throne in the 1,000-year period. I'm saying that Ezekiel is looking at it from that point, and what I have to suggest that is a chapter later in Ezekiel 44, when he says, then he brought me back to the way of the gate of the outward sanctuary, which looketh towards the east, and it was shut. Then the Lord said unto me, this gate shall be shut, it shall not be opened, and no man shall enter by it, because the Lord, thy God of Israel, hath entered in by it, therefore it shall be shut. So I don't know, really. There are other indications that were, and let me continue reading, because verse 3, the next verse, almost sounds like it will be, it sounds almost different. It says, it is
For the prince, he shall sit in to eat the bread before the Lord. He shall enter by the way of the porch of that gate, and shall go out by the way of the same, by the porch of the gate. Then he brought me to the way of the north gate before the house. I looked. Okay. So, and I haven't read in detail over these, the rest of this book of Ezekiel, because it does seem like there are a lot of indications that they're talking about a millennial here. It says, talks a lot about forever and ever, you know, these things are going to be happening. When it talks about the glory of the Lord, the God of Israel, came from the way of the east, and his voice should be, and it was according to the appearance of the vision, which I saw, even according to the vision I saw when he came to me to destroy this city. And the visions were like the vision I saw by the river Chebar, and I fell upon my face. And the glory of the Lord came to me in the house by the way of the gate, whose prospect is toward the east. So the Spirit took me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of the Lord filled the house. And I heard him speaking unto me out of the house, and the man stood by me, and he said unto me, Son of man, the place of my throne, the place of the soles of my feet, where I will dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever, and my holy name shall the house of Israel no more defile, neither they nor the kings by their whoredom, nor by the carcasses of their kings in their high places, in their settings of the threshold of my thresholds, and their post of my post, and the wall between me and them. They have even defiled my holy name by their abominations that they have committed, wherefore I have consumed them in my anger. Which seems to indicate this is after the Gog Magog war, where he consumed them in his anger. That's a specific thing. Now let them put away their whoredom and their carcasses of their kings far from me, and I will dwell in the midst of them forever. Okay, this is pretty significant part of it. This is in Ezekiel 43, verse 9, and that's pretty clearly saying that this is talking about the millennial. This is millennial prophecies. This is a millennial temple. And the paradox here then becomes, why are they having sacrifices? And Chuck Missler seems to deal with this. And again, I'm not sure what Missler thinks about the double fulfillment of prophecy and how that and why that should be seen as a double fulfillment of prophecy, other than the fact that we see it happening right now. Which might be a good enough reason to think that there is, but he does address this paradox, at least realizing that this is talking about a millennial temple in Ezekiel, in the latter chapters of Ezekiel, and he says, another strange issue is the prominence of sacrifices in the millennium. It would seem that they are memorials after the fact, just as the sacrifices in the Old Testament were memorials in advance. Some suggest I've seen that it may be because, you know, as they were teaching tools about the Redeemer beforehand, like the lamb that was supposed to be taken in the house at Passover. And again, it's not talking about that in these passages, just very specific other. Maybe they are teaching tools for them afterwards. In fact, somebody says this, during the millennium, animal sacrifices will replace the Lord's Supper or communion as a memorial to the Lord's completed work on the cross. Children born during the millennium will have to choose to be saved, just like you and I. They'll use these sacrifices to learn about the Messiah, just as the Old Testament believers did. Before the cross, anyone who believed by faith that the sacrifices represented a coming Redeemer who would die for their sins was saved. In the millennia, anyone who believes by faith that the sacrifices represent the Redeemer who already died for his sins will be saved. Jesus died once and for all time. Some looked forward to it, while others will look back upon it. The objective is all for the same belief by faith. One thing that Missler is right about is that it is a paradox, you know, to have this mention of a sacrifice in the what seems to be a clear talking about a millennia issue. A sacrifice in the millennia is something that we've got to study to figure out why, for sure. And like I was saying before, there's just not a lot of revelation about the millennia period or why or what's going on or, you know, what it's even going to be like. So it's really something that we need to study to determine that something can or shouldn't or should be happening there, because we just don't have enough information to determine what should or shouldn't be happening, I don't think. But that being said, I'm not sure that this whole Ezekiel 40, 41, 42, or whatever, and 43 and 44 have to be, you know, included in Ezekiel 38 and 39 as comparing it to Revelations 20. I mean, that even regardless of the whole temple thing, we're still having the War of Gog Magog and Revelations 20 after the millennia has happened. After a completed 1,000 years, then Satan will be let out, and then we have the War of Gog Magog. So the burden of proof now is to find any reason to suggest it is a double fulfillment of prophecy, other than the fact that it seems to be happening on our TV screens, and if we're doing a little bit of research, we can find this kind of thing happening. I haven't found anything to suggest that it's a double fulfillment other than seeing it on TV, which might be a good enough reason, but we also have to take into account, what if somebody's making that happen? Because if you look at the kinds of things that we're provoking Russia to do and making sure that they, I mean, it's almost obvious that we're wanting Russia to think it's Israel. They've infiltrated Israel in order to fund things like the Georgian army, it's so obvious to Russian intelligence that that was all essentially Israeli money and funded and all the weapons and stuff like that to get that, provoke that attack. And then we put the missiles in Poland and everything else, which is obviously a clear provocation of nuclear war to Russia. I mean, talk about putting hooks in their jaws. That's what we've been talking about on this show for the whole time. That's why it's been like, this has got to be the War of Gog Magog, because they're putting hooks in the jaws to do this, you know? And so we have to consider the possibility, because it does seem really mannish how this provocation is going on, and some of the conspiracy kind of things that, you know, it should be taken into account as well, is that George Herbert Walker Bush's nickname is Magog in Skull and Bones. And so that suggests that he knows a little something about the Gog Magog wars, probably heard the scenario before. So, and there might be some very good deception in getting the whole church to think that this is the fulfillment of Gog Magog war, and as Frank put it, maybe it is the war. Maybe just because it's being provoked by them, maybe it is that war, as well as the war that will happen later. I'll say it like this: what if it does start out like that, but doesn't end like that? What if something that would destroy our faith happens, and then we're like, that looks like God lost where he said he was going to win? Or what if this is just a rumor of a war, which Jesus said we would also encounter? What if it's not actually going to actually happen like this, but it's just a war and a rumor of war? And I'm not saying this discounts anything about, like, let's say, this coming global conflict of World War III. I think that we are in the middle, on the cusp of World War III, that is going to be this, used as this great destruction and great chaos, that out of which they intend and have planned to bring the phoenix to rise out of their ashes, their completion of the New World Order, and the Antichrist will rise out of this World War III. Do you need a specific prophecy in the Bible to have a World War III or a World War II or a World War I? I don't think so. I think you can have them quite apart from any specific places in the Bible. That being said, there probably is indication of it somewhere in the Bible, of this war, even if it's not the Gog Magog war, probably somewhere. So I think that needs to be taken into account. And I also don't think that you should be disheartened that this somehow means that the rapture is far away or whatever, or something like that. You don't need the Gog Magog war to have a rapture at all. This, I still think we're in the middle of something. This is about to all go down. In fact, I think it's even closer than ever. That's why I initially was doing the search on this in the first place. Because, I mean, I won't go into the study here, but if you look into, like, the Feast of Trumpets and the fact that, you know, that's the people would, the Jewish tradition was, that's what they would say, no man knows the day or the hour of Rosh Hashanah, the Feast of Trumpets, because it would either fall on one of 2 days depending on the moon cycle, because it was based on the moon. So that's what they would say there. You have that whole thing with it being on a Jubilee year, potentially, that is the rapture itself, or the coming of Jesus. So I think that you should take into account that we may be looking at that by the end of the month, which is Rosh Hashanah, the end of this month. It's the first of, it's either the last of September or the first of October. No man knows the day or the hour. But it's also a Jubilee year, which happens, what, like every 50 years or something like that? I'm not convinced on that, but there's a study there. I mean, we could be talking about that at the end of the month. I'm not saying this negates any kind of thing like that, because the only thing, as far as I can tell, that we're waiting on as far as getting out of here is a falling away must happen first, and the man of sin must be revealed. And my version of that, the way I really think that's going to happen, is those things are very, very intertwined, because as you may or may not know, I think that is referring to the Black Awakening, the falling away, which his entire purpose is to be a coup to reveal the Antichrist when the dust settles from it. So I think that those two things are intertwined. I think it's intertwined as well in the fifth seal of Revelations, which is, I think, where we're at, where the saints are crying out, how much longer till we're redeemed? And the answer comes that we're still waiting on a few more martyrs like you. And then, you know, and then I think that that's what this would be. This Black Awakening would be, if nothing else, it would be a major martyrdom of Christians, which would apparently provoke the rapture, which is, I think, what you see in the sixth seal of Revelation, which is the earthquake, which I believe is caused by the rapture itself, which would cause such great turmoil, because it would be all over the world, because there would be resurrections all over the world. And it would cause tsunamis, it would cause great turmoil, that it would, before the dust settled from that, nobody would ever realize what had happened. And by that time, it would really open the door for evil, because there would be no more Christians, so they could show up in their whatever deception they want to, saying the reason why they disappeared is because they weren't ready for the New Age, you guys are, let's get this thing started. So that's my crazy eschatology at this point, but who knows what it's going to be tomorrow after all this stuff that's coming out. So, you know, send me your emails about this. I don't know. This is probably, as I said, you know, this is going to be a touchy subject. Everything that I've been touching on lately has been a touchy subject. So, in fact, I got another thing just right on the horizon here that's also going to be some interesting stuff. So you can go to the website, which is nowheretorunradio.com. You can email me at Chris, C-H-R-I-S, at conspiracyclose.com. nowheretorunradio.com, Chris at conspiracyclose.com, Revelations Radio Network. Take it easy.